here. But this is good. So, we have been doing so many external talks, and I feel like, oh, we need to, get back to more of the routine
Oh,
of just like talking about research and
run it back.
progress and things that we're thinking about and helping each other think through, our experimental settings. And, I kind of want to have this meeting be a forum where you can come with like the knotty, problem that's just like in your way in research, or the puzzle that you're trying to think about. Just like to share it. Have us just chat openly about it. So yes, right. So we're gonna try to create more of these kind of things, Koyana, right?
Yes.
Try to do that every week instead. Are we failing at that?
I mean, next week we have Cynthia and Sam. Sam, it depends if you consider him external or internal.
Yeah,
I
it's kind
guess
of external now.
internal now, but
Yeah.
MPF is like, I guess, I don't know.
Okay.
It's
Yeah.
semi.
Yeah.
It's like short
And
of
then June 6th, we do have an open slot for internal. So, oh, but you're out of town, which is why we have an external. Oh, I need to make sure we have an external file. I'll ship it across, but
Oh yeah, no, I'd be happy to.
yes.
Or look at.
Okay. Yeah.
But after that we have Kim as well. So
Okay. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing that we could do is we could have kind of a talk, like a time slot where we have multiple of us just
Giving all lightning.
going through the outlining. Do you guys think that we should do that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes.
I'm down. Yeah.
I mean, so on June 6th you are out of town. Do you think we should do just lightning talks around then, or do we want to do that
Maybe
like
it's good. I like to be here for that, but let's see. June 6th. That's okay. Maybe let me look.
Yeah.
can do June 27th.
Yeah, it's like,
Because I do feel like that's a little missing right now. Like, I don't feel like I'm currently up to date on like
With what everyone's
what
doing.
everyone else is doing,
So could be June 13th. I could probably get the folks to do something on June 27th.
You could do it both. You could do, right? You could do June 6th. Benefits to
So that was because in May it got pushed back. So and it's and with MDF, it's more like they're gonna bring someone who did something with Insight and like give a talk. So it's
I see.
maybe
So it's sort of external.
that is true.
Maybe we should just give them external slots.
Okay. Yeah, it's at 10 a.m. for it. Now I've been trying to put that as like a thing.
I think the
So
external slots at 10 a.m. and then
yeah.
internal ones at 12 is good, because
Yeah.
then that lets the internal ones like run way over
That's true.
if we want.
Yeah.
And
We
then
only have that for, I guess, June 20th, only just because like the other people will be flying from like in Israel.
okay.
Is this an internal slot and should I leave? Oh,
No,
it's not. Yeah, no,
no,
anyone is
no,
allowed
you
to hang out,
shouldn't.
but yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's like much less formal. It's like, this is what I'm doing right now. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, what are everyone's thoughts and like ideas
Sure.
for what to do? Like,
On that
that's,
note,
yeah, on that note, like, let's do that
let's
for
do
me.
let's do
Yeah.
that. Let's do that. So, yeah, Alex, thanks. This is
Okay,
great.
so I actually like haven't really, I think the last time I gave a talk, it was like on what's in the textbook, because that's what I
Yeah.
was thinking about at the time. So this is actually like, I haven't really talked about my research like at all really to like everyone else yet. So anyway, so like first semester, David and I kind of like circled around different like
Are you using
settings.
your audio, by the way, just in
Am
case?
I?
You
Can
should.
everyone else see it?
And I just want to see.
Maybe
Oh,
at the top.
where's your
Yeah.
audio?
Yeah.
You guys
Yeah.
can
You
hear?
guys can hear?
Okay, good, good, good. I'm
Yeah.
just making
Okay.
sure because we've been
Cool.
having audio
Wait. How
problems
do
for a while.
I go back? Oh, here we go. Okay. Yeah. So David and I kind of circled around like different general settings. Of like kind of areas to work in. And we kind of settled on the code setting, because for like a lot of reasons that I'm now like pretty black-pilled. I'm pretty like in for the code setting, because I think there's a lot of sort of super nice properties of working with code and trying to do interpretability on code that like language doesn't have. So you have all this formal structure in a programming language that makes it really concrete to come up with experiments, because you have all these like formal guarantees with programming languages that like you don't have in English. And it's just a lot more like tangible a lot of the time. And I also would make the argument that it's like quite understudied, because you know, I mean, there's like Francesca in Arjun's lab. There's like some other papers, but you know, in comparison to the number of studies that are, you know, doing stuff with language, the language studies kind of dwarf it. The reason, my argument for why that is means it's understood studied is if you actually look at what people use language models for, a very, very large plurality of like what people are using language models for in practice, particularly like Claude, is writing code. You know, I mean, like Cursor has like a gazillion users now, right? And so code is actually like a really, really important topic to look at, because and like some very large, like I think like 40% of Google's like code now is like LLM generated. And you know, if you look at the new, like the Claude release yesterday, for instance, if you look at the benchmarks, it was like half coding benchmarks, right? So all these companies are like really focused on making models better at coding right now. So I think it's sort of like a kind of a hot topic to study. There's like a lot of different questions that you can ask in the code setting. Some of the ones that I'm interested in are, you know, so the current thing that I've been looking at is, do LLMs track variable states? So if you like define a variable in Python, and then that variable changes over the course of your Python program, does the LLM know what all the intermediate states of that variable are? You know, like, does it need to know that in order to produce good outputs? And if so, you know, can you localize that? Can you like find a representation for that inside the model? So some other questions are on the training process, right? So where in the training process do LLMs learn coding abilities, and what coding abilities did they learn? How does that work? Do they learn like skills that where you need some set of skills in order to build the next ones? And like with human learning, for instance, you know, like psychology, you know, learning in psychology is this huge field that's happened since like the 70s, right? And with humans, you know, you look at like human experts learning chess, right? And a novice at chess will be trying to memorize like every individual piece and where it is on the board. And like a chess expert will, you know, the fundamental units for a chess expert is groups of pieces, right? And like patterns of board states, right? And that's like chunking, right? And so do LLMs do something like that as they're learning how to code? Is it like an entirely different mechanism? You know, there's all these sort of questions that you can ask about the learning process here. Is there performance, you know, as measured empirically by like performance on like a coding task? Does that improve continuously over the course of training, right? Like performance on benchmarks, or does it do like some grokking thing where, you know, it learns very quickly? And if it does some grokking thing, does that happen on like a subset of problems that all have the same type of property, right? Or is it like, you know, like yeah. And then I'm also really inspired by this by this work by Wattenberg and Viegas. So I thought this was really, really cool. You know, and I thought like, you know, if we could build something like this, but for code, it would be great. So just to you know, and this will like lead into my motivation for the current project. So just to tell you guys a little bit about what this is. This was this paper that Martin Wattenberg and like Fernando Viegas made like a year or two ago or something, that I've seen Wattenberg like present a few times. And it's essentially like on, I think it was like on like Llama 2 or something. So it was like a while back, but they trained probes on on what a chatbot thinks your demographic properties are. So you know, they trained probes at every layer on the age of the person talking to the model, and their socioeconomic status, and their education level, and their gender. And then as you talk to the model, you can like look at these little toolbars like changing in probability as the model starts to build a better and better picture of you. And so I thought that was really, really cool. And I was like, man, if we could do something like that and build an interface, but for like when you're writing code, right? You could have some interface that's like, this is what the model thinks all of the variables are in this Python program. And like, this is you know, this is like what the model thinks all of the types are in the program. And like, this is, you know, the model knows immediately what like programming language we're working in, right? And then like, you know, you could see it like, you know, say you like you know, you call some like Triton code or whatever, right? Like, does the, you know, do you see some area where it's like starting to think about C code or something, right? You know, so I think there's sort of like interesting potential there. And so that was like a little bit of my motivation. So the current project is like getting slicing off like a very small chunk of this, which is, do language models represent variable states as you change them, and can we track down where? And so this is like super incomplete right now. You know, so I'll, you know, hopefully have some like more experiments on this pretty soon. But so the problem setup is pretty straightforward. You initially, yeah.
He has a slide here. Actually.
That's true.
Okay.
Fair enough, go for
So here's like my like current experimental setup. And like I had this slide earlier that I kind of like glazed over, but like I'm super not confident about like any of this setup. And so if anybody has like ideas for how to improve the setup, or like make anything better, or like interesting ideas for experiments, then like just interrupt me as I'm talking. Yeah. So the setup right now is you initialize some variable, call it X, at some number, call it 0. And then in the most basic form of this, you just pick some random number V, and then you either add or subtract V from X, and you do this for like a few lines of code. And then at the end, X has some internal value, and you ask the model, what's the value of X now? You know, and so in order to know what the value of X is, the model during its forward pass, and I like take off chain of thought. I'm like, no, just only tell me the value of X. Don't give me anything else, because I don't, because then you could just store the intermediate values in the chain of thought, and it'd be cheating. So in order to get the value of X, you need to like know these intermediate states in order to like do the calculation during the forward pass. You know, I've tried lots of other versions of this experiment. The first version that I tried was like much more complicated, and it used like, it also had like multiplication in it, and then it had like modulo division, and like, you know, take the absolute value of X, like you like kind of mix and match operations a lot. You know, and then I, you know, this is kind of the very simple version of it. Yeah, so this is my prompt. You're given a short Python program. The task is to compute the final value of the variable X. Return only the integer without commas, an equal sign, or any additional text. The integer should appear immediately after the word is. And then I put in the whatever the program is into this. And then you know, if all goes according to plan, the model outputs an integer right here during the generation.
You're not giving the comments that it's
Sorry, what?
I'm curious, you're just giving the program.
Yeah, just the program. Yeah, no, none of these. Yeah, you don't get these comments. Yeah. That would be cheating. These comments are just for illustration.
Like,
Yeah.
in the, whether like any of these are like already memorized by the model or not, and like yeah, things like that.
What is these?
So for like for example, the groups add sub multiply division, and like you just ask for like a code for that, like the likelihood is that that particular code may have appeared many times in the training and things like that. So does it matter if like that has been trained before or not? Do you
Well, I
really?
think that's one of the questions is like, did it memorize it in the training process or, or is it actually like, does it have an internal state, that it keeps track of X and then it's like, cause like if it's memor like say it's memorized, say it has some table, right? Just for like, I don't know, from 0 to 100 or whatever. And it has like one of like some inside the model somewhere is some like 100 by 100 table that like pretty accurately has all possible summations on like the lower diagonal for like every pair of integers from 0 to 100 or whatever, right? And like some version of that exists internally to the model, right? So that would get you like from one line to the next one, but then you have like, you would need like a combinatorially bigger table in as you increase the number of lines. So I think it would still be interesting if it had that table. But then it was using that table at each line to like add each integer like as it went, and then it was keeping track of the states, right? Like, because I don't think it's possible for it to like, once you get to like 5 or 10 lines or whatever, like you just have like so many, it's like there's combinatorially more possibilities, right? And like you wouldn't be able to store that, or it would be like super inefficient to store that internally, right? So it turns out the models are like not that great at this. Like they're okay, but so I kind of like looked at a ton of different models, just to like kind of get a sense. One caveat here is I like one I was like I didn't I wasn't really using like Nagoya or Hakone that much because they kept being like full. And so I was a little bit limited to use like most of these models are like less than maybe 20 billion parameters. So it's like roughly between like I think the smallest one here is like this 1.3 billion DeepSeek Coder model. And then the biggest one is, I think, a 14 billion parameter model. And they do get better, like as you increase model size, and we'll like see that in a little bit.
Did you upload them in like the full version or like default 16 and things like that?
Dfloat 16, yeah. So this is another like. The way the setup was, I loaded them in Bfloat 16 with left padding. And I had a temperature of 0.8 on all. I just used the same settings for all of them. So I think I had a temperature of 0.8 for all of them. And then each of these data points is sampled. I think I had it sampled 100 times for each of these data points. And then each of them is the average of 100 samples of the same sequence length.
The sequence length is token sequence or examples.
Oh, that's number of lines.
Okay.
So in this example sequence, a sequence length of 3 would be x equals 0, x plus equals 3, x plus equals 1,
Yeah.
and that would be a sequence length of 3.
One thing that I find a bit maybe counterintuitive is that this is hard and this feels more of like a math reasoning task than a coding task.
I
Like
agree.
in coding, you don't usually see like who would program that, right?
You would do it in a for loop or something,
Yeah,
or like even you wouldn't even do that.
exactly. So
That's a good point.
I feel like if you're testing, if you want to test coding abilities, and if you're also using coding models, I would try like a setup where you have like a definition of a function, then you call your function, then the function has some like if else, and then you have to keep track of like whatever the thing is, and you sum something, and then it's like a yeah, a conditional, and that's what happened. You can simplify it just like to start with, but I'll do something that is more code and Yeah, more than just like mathematical reasoning interfaces.
Yeah, I agree with that. So like one of the things that didn't make it to these slides that I did during the fall was a bunch of I looked at a bunch of problems in the human eval data set, which is you have it's just a bunch of Python functions, and then it's like a prompt to generate a function that does a particular thing, and then the model does it is solves it successfully if it passes like a unit test based on that prompt. And so yeah, I mean, I have a bunch of stuff with that. I think that data set is probably a little bit too complicated because like I want to keep it really simple, right? So that I can have like good se like sequences that are yeah, like kind of concrete. Yeah, so and I feel like once you get really simple, the line between math and code gets a little bit blurry, right? Like because I have, and you'll see this in a bit, I just this week I did like an experiment where instead of adding integers, it's doing different Boolean operations on like true false variables. And like that's kind of more coding, but you could also argue that that's like Boolean logic, which is like a math, right? So yeah, so I think I have to think about like, yeah, like what is a coding setup where you can still do like basically exactly this experiment, but it's something that like you would see in the wild, you know, during like a software engineering thing.
I don't know if
I
you
don't know.
discussed it. What about something where you kind of like have a for loop and then you're printing stuff when a condition is met given some input variable? And then you ask the model what's the output of this or something like that.
Yeah, that could be interesting. Let's see. Yeah.
Like a
So
key. I don't know if
yeah,
that
you loop
works.
through some list or something, and then when you hit like, I don't know, some it's like a list of like strings, and then yeah, you could do something like that.
You
Yeah.
were like trying to check like every model three to this if whatever else, and
Yeah.
then you have like three variables and the model has to like keep track of those three, or like if you can start with one.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. Yeah, I have like a bunch of you can also I also was thinking about doing something with like types, right? Like what's the type of this variable and how does it change over time? The reason I didn't do that initially is because Francesca in Arjun's lab already did like she wrote a paper that was all about like type representations. But yeah, I should go reread that paper, and there's plenty of stuff to do there that doesn't like isn't overlapping. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different forms that this experiment could take. So yeah, I think yeah, it's a good point.
I was gonna ask what sequence life meant. And
Yeah.
we're just adding and subtracting in that chart
In this
over
case, yeah. So I mean, you can see these operations down here that I just like commented out. So I was doing like a lot of other stuff besides adding su and subtracting, but I've like heavily simplified it because models just like were not able to solve this task at any reasonable accuracy. And
there.
like even when you simplify this much, they still can't really. I mean, it's okay, right? Especially sequence lengths of two. There's like a big cluster of models that do like quite well. You know, like this pink one is Qwen 2.5. Like the Qwen models typically did like pretty well here, at like low sequence lengths, which kind of like it makes sense because you know if you have x equals 5, x plus equals 3, what's x? Then you can just refer to some lookup table internally, and then they kind of even out around like a sequence length of 6-ish. Right, like they kind of drop pretty quickly from like 2 to 6 down to like a 50% accuracy, which is still above random chance. You know, I mean, random chance would be at close to zero, right? So it's still above random chance, and then it kind of evens out.
Have you first tried how good these models are at addition and subtraction? Or are you just trying to
Well, add base
go
addition
just
and subtraction?
and
Oh,
yeah.
without any like sequence length number?
Or just
Just
if
to
you pose semantically the exact same math problem, but write it, present it like a math problem as opposed to like a code problem.
What do you mean by present it? So
Like
like
just a mathematical expression.
like 0 plus 3 minus
Yeah.
1 plus 4.
Oh, I see. Oh, like not on different line. You mean on the same line rather than different lines? I haven't checked that. I've checked. I'll show you guys in a second. I like checked doing this in a for loop instead of doing it in different lines of code, and it gets a lot better when it's doing it in a for loop, which is sort of interesting. I also so I checked in a for loop rather than in different in like its own line, and then I also checked you add the you just add the same number every time within that for loop, and like models get to like close to perfect accuracy. I'll show you guys in a sec. And then I also checked you have a for loop, but then you still sample, and they do like much better if it's like even if it's like sampling and it's a for loop, which is like kind of weird.
The other thing is that are these values always single digit? The
these values the each
code.
v.
Yes.
Yeah, that's like a parameter in the function that I have set up to do it, but I've been using
But then
either 0 to 5 or 0 to 10, depending on the experiment.
it makes sense if that you expect it to like refer to some sort of lookup table,
Yeah.
right? Because if the values are large, then it's
Yeah, it
small.
won't have a lookup table, yeah. But if they're small, yeah, it would have a lookup table probably. Yeah.
Alex, I came in a little late,
Oh.
but the your goal is to understand if there's a if these models keep track of their variables. So.
Yeah. My goal eventually will be say you give this entire sequence to a model, and then you say what's the final value of X? During that forward pass, can you go back to this spot and does the model know what X is at this line of code?
So
Right,
like
like
the
does it
entire
keep track of all of these or like does it just somehow just I don't know the final value from I don't know magic.
sorry for cutting into this, but
Yeah.
it does not really have to be magic because
Yeah.
it's addition and subtraction, it's
Right.
associative,
Yep,
right?
yep,
So it
yep.
can chunk these
Yep, yep,
things
yep,
and
yep.
then adjust
Exactly.
visually.
Yeah.
So
So,
that would be really interesting if the model actually does something like that.
totally. Yeah. So yeah, you're totally getting it. That's why this original experiment was much more complicated, was this setup had this like super long function that I spent a bunch of time on to make sure that it like couldn't be associative. So I set up these operations so that you picked an operation, and then at every line it deleted all operations that it could pick that would make the program associative. And so every program that it made was like fully non-associative. And they like didn't do well. And so now I went back to like, okay, maybe it's fine if it's associative. And that's this addition of subtraction thing. And it's a little bit better when it's just addition and subtraction, and I've like gotten rid of the whole like associativity constraint thing. But like they're not it's not that different. The associativity thingy was like
The
basically
thing.
this, but slightly worse, but not that much worse. Yeah, they're pretty close to equivalent. Yeah.
So, one other thing you might be interested in is like, what other kinds of properties. So instead of just like taking one variable that's an integer and adding a bunch of stuff, like maybe you have some list and you can check like whether the model knows the length of a list or like
Yeah.
knows the sum of a list
Yeah,
or
yeah.
like
I was
a
thinking about that
string and
too.
like knows
Yeah.
what the elements in the string are or stuff
Yeah.
like that, you
Yeah.
know, like
I think I should just have like 2 days where I just like sit down with a chatbot and like try a bunch of these different like forms of this.
yeah,
Because yeah, I
I
think
guess
there's
I
so
should
many
check
different
into that. I have a
questions.
similar thing that this doesn't really feel like code.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So to that, I think the Python alpaca data set might be useful because I just noticed that it has like some instances of like the setting where you have like a list that you just either want to print or modify the string
Oh,
and
okay.
it remove punctuation and things like that. So maybe you
Yeah.
can just run that data set and see how well it does.
Yeah. Another thing I was thinking about was like giving it like NumPy arrays or like PyTorch tensors, and then doing some reshaping operations, and then like does it know the shape? Yeah. That I mean, and that seems like a much more like standard coding thing that it that like you would expect it to be able to do if it like needs to generate PyTorch code. And that like knowing the shape of a tensor seems like really important if you want to generate good PyTorch code. And like in practice, it feels like they do know the shape of tensors when I like have a model write PyTorch code for me. So yeah,
Yeah.
maybe that can be like a thing to try next with.
I think I would start with like just Python code first. Seems like
Just
simpler
basic,
than
yeah. Because it's
that.
more gen, it's like not
Yeah, like
specific,
I
yeah.
obviously haven't like really used all these models, but I have at some point tried with like ChatGPT or DeepSeek as in PyTorch questions. And they're not as good as in all the other stuff I've used
Right.
them for. Like sometimes it's just like that's wrong. And
Yeah.
then the model will like try to say like that
Yeah.
doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's like I'm not sure in those cases, maybe it's too complex and they don't have this like latent representations of what they need. And then
Yeah.
just like mostly like copy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I would start with like simpler Python setups and then move on to that once you have like a better sense of how things look.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Especially because like during the training process, it saw basic Python stuff, you know, orders of magnitude more than it saw like shape changing operations in PyTorch. So,
Are the tasks that these like the code only models generate? Are they generating code or are they answering questions about code? What are they trained on?
they can
oh, what are they
train.
trained on? They're trained on,
What about
I think it,
generating code?
yeah.
Yes. Code
Yeah.
prediction.
Lots of code generate. Yeah, there's a lot of like, it's like a mixture of like cleaned up like code data sets pulled from GitHub, like and like a lot of synthetic code that is like you there's a lot of like rejection sampling stuff where you like, you know, you have a model, you know, you ask a model to like generate like a bunch of different classes of like ideas for functions that you would see in the wild, or like classes that you would see in the wild, or whatever, and then unit tests for those, and then you like do rejection sampling with this generation process where you like get rid of anything that doesn't like pass the unit tests, and then you like create a data set out of that. That's like pretty common.
It like probably not a huge deal, but like on the margin, if you set up the prompts to be less like here's a question I have about the code, but more like complete this code and you can only complete it in certain ways that are enforced by the program that you gave, right? So like the type annotation would be the same on this.
Yeah, yeah. 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 I agree. Yeah.
A setup that seems very similar to me is I don't know, one of our lab members had done the setup where there's a box A, there's a carrot in the box, person B came and removed the carrot, put something else, and somebody tracked it over the time. If the model knows what's in box A,
Yeah.
seems very
That was
similar.
Nikhil. That was like Nikhil's stuff, right?
There's entity tracking, I think.
Yeah.
It seems very
It's
similar.
yeah, it's pretty similar. Yeah, I was actually thinking about that. Yeah, maybe I should. It's a shame. Where is Nikhil? He's like
He's
not
at
here right
Apple.
now. Oh, he's at Apple. Oh yeah, he's doing an Apple interview. Yeah, well, that's a shame. Because yeah, I have actually had that thought. I haven't really talked to Nikhil about this, but some of this stuff feels kind of similar, but like in code instead of like in rabbits in boxes and stuff.
Did
So
you try like regular language model, not a code model?
well, I tried all these, and some of them are code models, and some of them are just normal language models. I think like most modern models like are kind of are code. Like they like people have been putting a lot of effort into making like models good at code now, and so like when you see a new model, it'll typically have been like it'll be good at code, even if it's not called like a code model, you know. Yeah. So.
Thought it was like there was like a parallel to a theory of mind, but at the same time, I think it goes like much more beyond it, and it's like a more controlled setup because, like, in theory of mind, you have like all the compounds with reality, right? Like, is the box transparent or not? Where, like, in code, it's like no, things are the way they are, and like there's no misinterpretation. This code compiles, and the model is like has seen so much code that it like really knows all the syntax and so on, and like the logic, right? So
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think you get like a lot more than like, sure, this is like the first setup, right? Or like what the model knows, what the variable encodes, but you can go like way beyond with like for loops, functions, and classes.
Totally.
Along those lines, and also along the lines of having the question that you're asking being enforced by the program, I wonder about like just give it a simple program in a compiled language and just ask it, does this code compile? And if no, what is the error?
That's, I mean, that's an interesting thing to like train a probe on too, right? Like, does this compile? And then the probe is just binary, like, because that's like a yes or no. Will this run into an error or will it not? I like that task actually. That's like a simple task and like very easily checkable, and it's like a binary, very solid question.
Honestly, the rest of your
Yeah,
your
yeah.
talk
So
goes fast.
let's keep going.
We keep on we do this a lot.
I know, I know, I know.
Yeah.
Because there's gonna be like a whole other project that I've been doing with Steven as well. That hopefully we'll have time to get
Okay, so
into.
zoom through.
Okay, so so I like test all these models, and then I kind of zoomed into the Qwen series because they were typically just like pretty good. It was either Qwen or Gemma, and they both were pretty good. This is just looking only at Qwen. We can see that as you increase model size directionally, they get a little bit better at this task. So maybe if I use the full big boy version of Qwen, it would be, I haven't checked that, because it was annoying to load onto memory, but maybe they'll get better. So this is like the 14 billion parameter Qwen here. The red is the average of all the Qwen models. So this is what I was talking about before. If you do this all in a for loop, and so you generate some random z between 1 and 10, and then you don't change z at all, so it's you're literally adding the same value every time, and then your program is for I in range, whatever your sequence length is, x plus equals z. So if z is 2, then it's just adding 2, sequence length number of times. So that just collapses into a multiplication problem, right? Seems like the models know that, right? So the smaller Qwen doesn't, the 500 million parameter Qwen like doesn't realize that that's a multiplication problem. But as soon as you get into like, more than like 1.5 billion parameters or so, they basically get perfect accuracy if it's just a for loop with the same number. Literally the same problem, but instead of a for loop, you're doing the new lines thing. It gets much worse. So it stops being able to. My guess is like this one, it goes into a multiplication table. And then this one, I don't know, doesn't or something. So it gets a lot worse here when it's the previous thing, except with different lines of code. And then now if we sample z is a different number every time, now we're kind of back to the old problem, it gets even worse. Here's z is the same at every part of the for loop, and then here is z is randomly sampled between 1 and 10 for each line, but still lines of code.
In these cases, does your prompt change, and how, like, how would the model know what the random number is?
So here you're giving the model is given a sequence like this, right? Whereas here, it's 2 2 2 2 2 2 2 2, that kind of thing. And then here it's not 2 2 2 2 2 2, it's like a for loop. And then I also have this Boolean setup. I also like was a little bit irresponsible scientifically, and I added a in context learning little bit thing here to, you know, so I should probably do it again without this, but this is like a Boolean task. We do Boolean operations on true false. Now we have some other variable y that we don't want to predict, but we just use y as like a method to, you know, do Boolean operations on x. I should probably give an example of like one of these sequences, but it's the same as before. It's like a bunch of new lines, but each new line is either not and or with x paired with, so x equals x and y, x equals x or y, and x equals not x. So you sample from one of those, and then that's the new task. And so I should probably have the old task and the new one next to each other, but it's a bit better here. Right, if you look at the y-axis values, we're a little higher, but also predicting the final value of x is you're predicting a Boolean, so now random chance is at 0.5, so it's a little bit harder to like compare apples to apples here, right?
Oh, it's smarter. That's smarter.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, maybe it should just be like x equals x and true or something. X equals x
X
or
equals true.
false.
X is equal to
X
true
equals false.
and
What's x?
X equals true.
X equals true, then not. I mean, you can
Yes.
always like tear out this operation, right?
So instead of
Like,
saying like y, it should be like x equals x and true, x equals x and false, x equals x or
and then
true, x equals
yes.
x or false, right? So you sample one of those. Yeah. Makes sense.
I'm really curious how you did the evaluation with. I'm guessing this would by accuracy, is that the logit of the token that corresponds to the correct zero or correct one, or are you actually like sampling repeatedly?
Oh, I'm sampling repeatedly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I didn't look at like logits at all. This is each one of these is like 100 samples, with like a temperature of 0.8.
Okay. I guess I was thinking you could probably simplify the pre-prompt considerably if you just if you're sampling and you're using like VLM or something, just highly logic bias, true and false or zero or whatever. Or just actually measure the logits, so you don't have to sample. I don't know if that'd be easier or not, actually. I don't know.
I think it would also be interesting to look at the logits and then how does that compare to the accuracy. Yeah, because like theoretically they should be close to each other, but maybe in practice they're not, and then that would be kind of weird, you know. But yeah, that's sort of, yeah, that's, I haven't thought about that actually. That'd be interesting to look at. So I have a bunch of experiments planned that are like actual interpretability instead of like evaluation stuff. So one of them is train probes on the last token to predict the final value of X at each layer, and then at what point in the forward pass for successful runs does it know the value of X? Another one is a causal mediation thing where you do two forward passes, and then you diverge the forward passes at like a particular point, and then the rest of them is the same. And then you're asking, does patching activations from the second one into the first one cause the model's final prediction to shift towards what it would be if the model had processed the second sequence, right? And then that kind of gets at this like internal state representation question. David and I were talking about Atticus Geiger's stuff, which I've been slightly irresponsible and haven't dove into, but DAS and HyperDAS and that stuff, I think is like an interesting set of methods to try out on this problem.
I guess like if the model can't do it, yeah, it doesn't seem worth it
Yeah, I
to
agree.
try it out
Yeah,
that way.
yeah.
So I feel like
So
you
the
need to
first thing is still like
pin down a problem that
pin
the
down
model
something where
can
it can
do.
do. So yeah, and
You have the for loop, you can
I
do
have
it.
the for loop. It can do the for loop. So I got one thing that it can do. So that's cool.
I was just really, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just really curious as like what are the failure cases? Like, do you know like what the distribution of the wrong answers are? Like, is it going like, sure, here's the like, is it starting a longer response that's not conforming to your pre-prompt ever? Or is it
Oh
just saying the wrong answer?
no, it's not that. I have like post-processing code
Okay.
that uses regex to like pick out to like pick out the thing. So even if it does that, I mean, unless like my code is bad, which that's like definitely possible, It should be picking out whatever the model thought it was, even if it has some weird prompt, or some weird output, as long as it like gives you a number. But yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at like I haven't like gone into that as much. Yeah, I should like look at a few manually and check that out. Yeah, so I guess like general feedback on this is probably switch out the task so that it feels it's like more in line with what you would find in the wild, but still has the property where you can do these kind of causal mediation analysis experiments on it and these probing experiments and stuff. Yeah.
This is actually natural, but like, well, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm not used to prompting models, but like for some reason just like the autocomplete seems better, it seems more natural to me, like predicting you know, like the next line or whatever. And so like do models actually see like I don't know, like a Python console where like you have like the prompt and then you can just say X and then the next line would be like the value of X. Or is that like, I don't know, a more natural way of like showing what is in the variable X, if that makes sense?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Print X.
Print
Yeah.
X, X. Yeah,
And then
yeah.
the, or
And
like
then the
the
model would output. Yeah.
or that instead of saying like, tell me what the error is, like you just get it to complete the sequence that's about to output an error and then it can show the errors.
That's yeah. I should switch it out to be like that.
I don't know, but I
Because
don't
because then I could have the whole prompt just be Python code,
Yeah.
and it would be like a lot more pure instead of
Yeah.
like. Hey model, here's this set of Python code. Could you like
Yeah.
tell me this thing about it? Yeah,
Yeah.
I see what you mean.
I
Yeah.
thought that at the beginning, but then the models that you were trying, they're mostly like chat and instruction
A
tool.
lot of the ones that I've been trying are instruct tuned.
And
Yeah.
so I don't know if that would yeah, maybe
There's a
it's
way you can
instruction.
still prompt it to an instruction tree. One solution is just use a base model.
Yeah.
But the other thing
But
is,
they're called base models.
yeah.
Not any super new
Well,
ones.
so, I mean, most of well. I haven't checked if Quinn has. I mean, Olmo definitely has their base model because I've played with that a lot. I mean, most model providers that I've seen that are like open source, like Quinn and Gemma and stuff, I think most of the time have their base model on Hugging Face.
One has base
Quinn has
models.
base
Quinn has
models.
base
Models, yeah.
but
Yeah.
even if you only have an instruct model, you could like have a user prompter like provide me some arbitrary Python code, maybe not that, but something with that effect, and then simulate as though the LM has already produced like the beginning of the Python IDE, like you said, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah.
And then just go all the way up to not the end of the assistant response. So it's as though the assistant started to give a response, but it just
Right.
needs to finish it and give
Yeah.
that
Right.
final output of like an example of like, you know, you have the x equals one, x plus equals, and then it's just that final little thing that it has to output right here in the
Yeah,
token
yeah.
example.
Right. Yeah.
No, I also like your current comments that you showed for our sake. I'm sure you're not showing that to the model.
Wait, which what?
Comments in the
The
code.
comments
Oh, yeah, of course I'm
you're
not.
not showing
Yeah.
to the
No,
model. Maybe
no.
you could. And then let it finish the comment. Like, what's the next in the sequence?
Oh, yeah.
That's another way to point it out.
Yeah. But I wouldn't want to give it the intermediate values in the comments because,
Why not?
well, because the point is to figure out if it's representing them internally. So if it's if they're stored in a token,
Oh.
then you're cheating.
You could give it one or two of them just to show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
Like the
Then
last
you could
one.
get it
You
going.
can lie to it in one of the comments and see.
Yeah, that'd be kind of interesting. Yeah. Can you train a probe that lets it that where it knows where you lied? That could be kind of an interesting experiment.
And that's how Stack Overflow shows all the answers right in the comments they show.
Yeah, that's sort of yeah, that could be an interesting direction is like yeah, how robust is it to being like misled? Yeah.
On the task choice, I don't think it should be dispositive, but I think it'd be really cool to have a task that has an analog, like natural language. And so
Yeah.
you could see if there's like some circuit that's kind of like multilingual.
Yeah. Multilingual, but instead of English French, it's like English code.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a
Oh,
cool
the box
question.
idea is still
Yeah, the
relevant.
box idea, Nikhil's box thing. Yeah.
I
Yeah,
see.
you could get a code equivalent to that.
Maybe
Yeah.
it's the same circuit. That'd be
Yeah,
so cool.
that would be very cool, actually. Yeah.
Still a dictionary.
Yeah. That'd be interesting.
State bracket.
Yep. And you have all these like
equals
pointers that it
at.
Yeah. That would be very cool. Okay. I have like an entire other section of this talk that's like the stuff that Steven and I have been doing. So I'm gonna run through that quickly. So this is like almost so to give you guys like a sense for the setting, this is like looking at training dynamic stuff. So for anyone not familiar with the OLMO models, AI2 put out these models, and the nice thing about them is it's sort of like the successor to Pythia, where they have their full training run. With every 1,000 gradient updates, they have a checkpoint that you can find online, and then they also have their entire data set also online. And then I check this. It's nice that you also know exactly what data point was given to the model at what gradient update. And it's like fully random seeded. So so you can go to gradient update number 1,500,000 400, and you can see what data was added at that update. Their recipe was pre-training for 4 trillion tokens, where you just throw tokens at it, and then what they called mid-training, which is the last 90% of the remaining 10%, last 10% of the pre-training run, they switched to higher quality tokens. And also at that run, they have these they did three different randomly seeded post-training mid-training runs starting at 90% of the way into pre-training that they called ingredients. And then they did like this model merging thing to get to the end of pre-training to get their base model. And then they did for post-training, they did SFT, and then they did DPO, and then they have this new thing that they called RLVR, which is reinforcement learning with verifiable rewards. And that's like generate a bunch of synthetic data that you can verify and then give the model that. So the instruct model is after RLVR, and the DPO model is after DPO. So the difference between them is this RLVR thing. They're like, I ran these a while ago on this is all on human eval, the human eval data set. And I looked at the correlation between pass rates with these different post-trained models. And the DPO and the instruct are like basically the same as far as I can tell in terms of like which problems they in terms of which problems they like get correct. And then the SFT kind of diverged from the DPO and the instruct a bit. And then this is the base model. So of course the base model was like way different than any of the post-trained models. But so just looking at this, it looks like DPO made a huge difference. RLVR, as far as I could tell, didn't really change that much.
So SFT DPO is SFT plus DPO, or is it just DPO?
SFT plus DPO. So it's sequential. So they did SFT first, and then they took the SFT model, and then they did DPO on it, and then they took that, and then they did RLVR on it.
And that's the instruct.
So that was their training run. And so this set of stuff. So like I said, so Steven over there has been working on this a lot as well. So the problem setting here is I've been doing a bunch of evaluations on different parts of the pre-training run and post-training run on this CruxEval data set. So this is I don't know if you guys can read any of the text here, but each CruxEval sample has a function, a Python function, that's typically pretty simple, and then it has some input to that function, and then it has the ground truth output. And they kind of take all shapes and forms. The inputs could be strings, sometimes they're lists, it's all kinds of different stuff. And so I'm testing on whether the model correctly gets the right ground truth output.
What's the generator thing? The generator using some other model?
What?
Generator.
This is what the model, this was like an actual example run where I was actually like evaluating model. So this is like me running it, and then generated is like what that model produced as the output, and then the true output is the ground truth. So like this one would be false, for instance, because the model didn't get the correct true output. And then like I guess all of these are false, but anyway. So you know, this was just kind of like a big picture observation of like what's going on with this you know, abilities in different sizes and fine-tuning setups. So I think Steven actually generated this this plot. So this is like the 32 billion, you know, does better than the 13 billion, does better than the 7 billion. And then the instructs typically do better than the base models. I have been kind of looking at the 13. So, oh, weird thing here, the 13 billion did like better than the 32 billion. I don't know why. I think it's just random chance. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Why is it stacked?
Oh, yeah, right. So, yeah. So, right. So, so the orange is, so the orange and the blue are, I was looking at the overlap in problems that were solved, by different models. So the, how is this set up? This was a while ago. Do you remember?
Yeah, the orange is basically all the problems that the model, not only that version of the model solved.
Right. Yeah.
And the blue is like something that at least one other model solved.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I wanted to, basically I'm interested in like robustness of like if I want to ask questions about like a model's ability to solve a particular type of problem, I want to know how robust that model, like if a problem is solvable by a model in one setting, I want to know like what's the chance that that problem is going to be solvable in another setting, because then you can get at questions of like, do models like have some kind of like semantic ability to solve this class of problem, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Basically, that's it. Yeah, consistency and generalizability. So this is sort of what, yeah.
Is it solvability? Like can you just literally mean whether it gets a correct answer? Because what if it like has that tracking, semantic tracking of like X or whatever you're considering, but it just ends up getting like something wrong?
Yeah, we're just measuring whether it gets the correct answer right now. Like maybe it does, but we're just looking at like, can it get the ground truth? So one kind of interesting thing that we were looking at is if you look at the pre-training, you have this sort of a very interesting phenomenon. So this is all base model, but this is these data points here are all, you know, that first 4 trillion tokens of pre-training. And then right when you hit mid-training right here, you immediately jump up to like from 0% of these problems being correctly solved to like not 0%, right? 6%. So not high, but there's 800 problems total, and 6% of 800 is like 60, right? So you, within like 1,000 gradient updates, you go from being able to solve no problems to being able to solve like 60 problems. So, you know, like we thought that was sort of interesting. So we're like zooming into that a little bit here.
You shot examples, or are you just giving the question for the base model?
I am giving, I have been messing with that, and sometimes it's few shot and sometimes it's one shot. I think typically I've switched to one shot because, I don't know. I feel like few shot kind
for
of
this graph.
For this graph, I think it's one shot.
You mean zero shot or?
Zero shot, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it might be good to disambiguate between like, can it follow instructions? Just can it solve the task?
Yeah. Yeah. So, as in like doing few shot would do that?
Yeah. Like
yeah.
Few shot, I guess that's a bit.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I've done few shot. Like, I have a function that does best of K sampling. And I think I just had the hyperparameter for that set to one here. But I was playing around with like 10, 40, and like 100, you know, in terms of like K shot success rate. And
no, but do you know what it'd be like by few shot? Like, like where the input has here's like three solved problems. Now here's a fourth.
Well, that's what you mean. Oh, I see. I see. Yeah, I haven't done any like in context learning stuff. But that, yeah,
I guess just because like
be good to try out.
Like historically when you use the phase model, sometimes you get just like it'll give you another question. Like I don't know
I
think I'm also curious if nothing really happens before the 5,000 steps, or maybe you can try
The
to
start of the
include
phase
some,
learning.
yeah, maybe if you kind of like include some maybe easier problems or easier settings to test the earlier steps, maybe there will be different.
So we actually so I'll just well I won't skip ahead, but just a little bit more like information here. These orange dots are those three ingredients that I talked about before. And then at the end here, that's the base model is this final orange dot, and that's the average weights of the training runs for these three ingredients. And then they're just different random seeds. So they're just that you all start with the model as it exists at 5,100 tokens, 5,100 billion tokens trained. But then you give different random seeds for the gradient updates, and then you just train them all separately, and then you combine them.
Okay.
So that's
Wait,
what they did.
you just add them.
They averaged them, and I like didn't know that that was a thing, and it just works. And I was like, "What? You can do that?" And that's like just what they did. And I was as shocked as you are. I like didn't know that that was a thing that companies did in pre-training. And apparently you can just average weights after doing this and it like makes a better model, which was like shocking to me, but apparently that's true. So, yeah, pretty weird. That's also something that I kind of want to like explore a little bit because that's weird.
The dumb question. Like, can you remind me what is the objective of this project?
It's so this is like I want to understand how a model learns to code over the course of training, and like more specifically, does it learn like it's like sort of a, like some like grokking questions, right? So like does it learn particular things within like small periods of time? What does it learn? Does it learn does it learn kind of how to solve code in this sort of chunking way where you learn like basic stuff first and then more complex stuff as the training run goes on, or like how does it work? The questions are like pretty broad right now, so like one of the things that I want to do is get a little bit more concrete. It's a little bit of like a look at the training run and then kind of like get a little bit more concrete with
I can tell you
what
what we wrote
questions
on
you
the
have.
grant.
Okay.
I don't know if we'll be able to get there, but it's the basic idea is, if you have a code LM that suggests an answer to you or helps you out in some code task, there's always this question like, how did it know that? It didn't know that because of some example it saw in the training data. So there's this, training data attribution question. And so sort of it seems like one elementary part of training data attribution, we could actually look at the training process to see like what did it see in the training data that caused it to be able to solve one specific problem. Can we even like get a single one of those cases? And understand that, yeah.
Code generation, it involves, I'm assuming that it involves a lot of subtasks, and you see this grokking phenomena when the model kind of like learns to solve all of these subtasks so that now it can combine all of these capabilities to something like code generation. Do you have an idea of what these subtasks might look like, and maybe like what are these subtasks that you are looking for? Like when you say that when the model has gained this capability for code generation, right? I feel like I don't know what that means.
I know what you mean. So there's a Cohere paper that looked at this that like laid out like here are some subtasks for coding that you can like break things into. And you know, and so there's like two other papers that I found that are like, here's like some ways to categorize, you know, different code problems. So I think, you know, once we get a little bit further, we're going to go through some of those papers and probably use one of their setups for how to, you know, how to actually like operationalize, like what does it mean to, you know, break, you know, problems into different subtasks kind of thing. But I think it's like, it's a bit of an open question too, because it feels like a little bit arbitrary, like what, you know, because you could also do some clustering thing where it's like, instead of like putting a label on different types of problems, you could just like, you could probably get it sort of dynamically where you know, where you kind of figure it out, you know, with some clustering setup. But yeah, I don't know. This is like a little bit like further down the line to like nail that one down. Yeah, this is zoomed in looking at every 1,000 gradient update. So basically it goes from can't solve it, and then you get to mid-training, and then it solves 8%, and then it kind of like stays roughly there. Like it doesn't really get that much better. So when you zoom in, and so Stephen just did this work like this week. So we just added this to the slides at like the last minute. So David hasn't actually seen this yet, but when you look at some of the specific generations, at the during this pre-training run, it turns out that we have this situation where it actually still has the correct output, but there's this like crazy amount of like weird noise that is added in its output generations that doesn't exist once you start mid-training. So like here, for instance, you know, you have this generated output, right? Which still isn't correct, but it's, you know, kind of in the right ballpark. But then you have like all this random crap after it, that like you don't have any of that noise when you move into mid-training. And that's true for like most of these things. And so and then if you look at the stage two starting, so this is in stage one. Okay. So this is, which checkpoint is this in stage one? Like where, how far along?
The very last.
Okay. So this is like the last checkpoint of stage one, and this is the first checkpoint is, so these are only 1,000 gradient updates apart, and you go from like a bunch of noise in these outputs to like immediately having like clean outputs, which is like kind of, to me at least, that's like pretty weird that like it only takes 1,000 gradient updates of like higher quality data to like go from this crap to like this much nicer crap. Yeah, so the stage two is like a curated selection of higher quality data set that I have a slide for that I like at the end of this that like goes into exactly what's inside of it. But it's basically like all the pre-training is like they just took the internet and threw it at the model. And then the last one was like they have these nice curated data sources that they're like all shutting in at the very end. And
These two of them would also add nicer data.
yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And but it's like, but then like in 1,000 update steps, it like is able to get to this from that. So
Is it just now knowing how to output end of sentence? There's like before
that could be it. Yeah.
say it, it's just like, I don't
It
know.
just like keeps going. Yeah. That might be it. Yeah. Yeah, maybe it's just like figured out how to do end of sentence or something here. I don't know, that's a good question. So, you know, yeah.
I don't know how they prepare their data, but could it be that when during stage one, just like concatenated all the documents that they had, and so there's like no,
Yeah, I feel, I
and
think,
once I hear, they maybe separate them in different examples.
yeah. So I think so, like I said, so Steven's been doing a lot of this work. So, you know, so I think like maybe one thing to do is like look at a bunch of examples of the pre-training data sets and the mid-training data sets and see how they're different. Because I haven't really like manually gone in and like looked at a bunch of the pre-training data, and I think like definitely it's time to go do that. And because you might be right, maybe they like it's all like concatenated crap, and so yeah. And then you can also see this with this generation length, the stage two beginning, like this is 1,000 gradient updates later, it has like a much smaller number of tokens that are generated than the stage one. So the stage one, I guess, just outputted a bunch of noise in addition to the like generated tokens. And you can look that over here too. Again, like Steven did this like yesterday. So yep. And then when you filter out,
I missed the new result.
yeah, you'll never see him again. So then when you filter by the first instance of a new line and then you reevaluate accuracy, it goes way up. Yeah, I mean, Steven, if you want to, you can explain what's going on here if you'd like in this graph.
Yeah, so basically, for each generated output, I just like cut it off at the new line and then reevaluate the accuracy. And as you can see, it's like much closer to the stage two starting checkpoint now. Although,
Yep.
yeah.
So,
Just learned
yeah. But
the
it learned very quickly. I think
Yeah,
that's the interesting thing. It's like it didn't learn over like, a million tokens. It learned in like 1,000 updates, like
oh, wait, 1,000 updates.
1,000 update steps. Yeah.
Yeah, but each step
Always
would
a lot.
Sorry. Yeah, each step has how many tokens per step? It's
It's
like
8 million per step,
eight
I
million per
think.
step. So sorry. So I misspoke. It's still a lot of tokens. It's 8 million times 1,000 tokens.
So
But in the grand scheme of things, that's not that many tokens.
I missed the result. So you're saying that before this checkpoint, it actually had the right answer, but it was putting extra garbage,
Yeah,
and then now, and
exactly.
then after it's just cleaned up its garbage. So
Yep.
it is a yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, a garbage cleanup situation is
I see. So if you just clean up the garbage for it, then even without the gradient, it has actually pretty good accuracy. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you can
I see.
reconstruct close to the
I see.
accuracy. Yeah.
I see. So
Yeah.
you might have to look back further in history to see what it
Exactly. Yeah,
learned the
yeah.
actual
And
thing.
clean up a little bit. Yeah. I mean, so one thing that Steven and I were like brainstorming earlier is like the like actual learning is sort of blocked here by this noise situation. So like you can't really do, this like black box evaluation in order to figure out how much a model knows about code, because it's blocked by all this noise, even though it like secretly actually does know, And so if you could make an interpretability based evaluation here where you actually get the true accuracy, right? Even if it's even if the output is noisy, I feel like that could be kind of an interesting paper, because now you're like, hey guys, when you're early in pre-training, like evaluations actually aren't telling the whole picture because it's noise, but the model actually does know how to solve this problem, if you take out the noise. But then if we can use interpretability techniques instead for evaluation early in pre-training, and you actually do get at the like true accuracy of the model. So we were like, just thinking like that could be kind of an interesting direction to go here, is like you using interpretability techniques as like an early stage evaluation method. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to know two things. So one is kind of like adding a bit to the earlier comment that I feel like, given that you're looking at pre-training, I wouldn't give the prompt as you're giving it. And I'm actually surprised that the model is this good.
During pre-training.
During pre-training,
During
yeah.
pre-training with an instruction of like solve this task in this way.
Bearing in mind that the y-axis is not accuracy. The y-axis is number of problems solved, and there's 800 problems total.
Okay.
So
Okay.
this is at like
But
6% accuracy. Yeah.
then also,
It's
again, like I
a
think
little bit misleading, sorry.
I would try to make the example on the prompt in such a way that is something that you would find in the internet kind of thing, like no instructions, because then you could get like even earlier probably when the model does not need to
Oh,
understand
yeah.
the use of these kind of instruction.
Yeah.
And then what was the other thing I wanted to say?
There was like
Yeah,
a
I forgot.
loss rather than accuracy.
Yeah. I was gonna say that there was a paper, I don't remember exactly the paper, but it was censored at some point in a reading group where people kind of like make the point that these are like emergent abilities are not so emergent if you look at a metric that is not so binary. So basically they're emergent and you're seeing like this plot because you're looking at accuracy 0 or 1, right? But
Emergent abilities are a mirage.
if you look at different laws, the model does learn this pretty linearly and it gets better and better. It's just that for accuracy, for getting like the one right token, it takes a while more, and then you only see it from 0 to 1.
I think that one, like ICML 2023 best paper or something, right? That was like a whole debate like 2 or 3 years ago. That's a good point.
So just to like always have it in mind that it's like maybe it's still growing inside. It's just that you're not seeing it because you're looking at accuracy. And maybe that's something that you want to do, and that's fine. But
Makes sense. We also did some robustness stuff, robustness to and
you had this point that says you want to use interpretability tools
mm-hmm.
to bring out the loss performance, you mean?
Yeah, to like, you know, so like if a model actually is good at solving these problems earlier in the training run, but you can't tell that it's good because the outputs are, you know, noisy, but you can predict that it's good with like, I don't know, like probing or something. Then, you know, maybe you can create an evaluation technique where like actually it's better to use probing early in the training run than it is to do these black box evaluations because that gets at like the true knowledge level of the model instead of you know, this like whatever the output is, you know.
Right. So basically, before fine-tuning, probably the capabilities are already present. You just need a way to bring it out.
I guess the thing I worry about there is that the baseline you have to compare to is pretty strong, which is just fine-tuning on the task at that checkpoint. And so, whether you can improve on that with probing or something like that, I don't know, but it's tough.
Getting close is still like pretty interesting. Like
Yeah, getting close.
from the base model,
Yeah.
getting close to your fine-tuned model without really fine-tuning
Yeah, that was
it's still
it.
like pretty
That would be cool.
surprising. If it happens. It's
It's a
a
big if,
big if.
but you know, but that would be cool.
But yeah, that maybe that's the upper bar, the fine-tuned bias.
I mean, I guess it's like you gotta, because you're still spending some compute on carrying the probe, and so it's like hard to know how you compare those.
Right.
Yeah, I guess
Measure
if you
flops
could
in training the
find,
float probe versus flops to fine tune.
if you could
You
find
could do
compute,
that.
that would be interesting.
Cool. This isn't that interesting. This is looking at the different ingredients in the stage two. This is the intersection over union. You take the first stage two checkpoint, so there's three total, and then you look at the intersection over union of that with the other two checkpoints. So this is just you know, another kind of like problem robustness question, just like the orange and the blue parts of the bar plot before. It's at about 50% intersection over union for most of the stages. So this is like, you know, if you do different random seeds, then you'll have about a 50% overlap in which problems they can solve correctly. Oh, and then this is some more stuff that Steven was doing. This is robustness to prompt. So I was also like, okay, how robust is like if a language model is answering coding problems? What I want to get at is it's like true understanding of how to solve the problem. And you know, what if changing the prompt like dramatically changes its ability to solve the problem? So what Steven did is you have this persona data set where you can pick out of like a million different personas, and then you say you are a, you know, AI engineer and here's your background. Now solve the problem, you know. And so Steven did that for like a bunch of different personas and looked at how the problem accuracy changed. And
Tricky here, man.
Yeah, it turns out GitHub contributor is the best one, and high school teacher is the worst one. And
What?
yeah, this is the instruct model 13, the instruct model for 13 billion, and it was about 2% better for a GitHub contributor and about 3.5% worse for a high school teacher. So this is about the.
Did almost as good as a Stack Overflow.
But
Isn't that crazy?
in a way, I've heard that it's funny, but I feel like if you want to measure robustness to the prompt, you really want to change some stuff in the prompt, maybe like the formatting or that sort of thing, right? Because here, maybe the model is doing exactly what it's supposed to do, right? Like a high school teacher, you would expect that it would be worse in this test. It wouldn't know about, I don't know, coding. Right? Like, probably not. So the model is just following the instructions, like doing what it's supposed to do.
Or maybe it's teaching.
Yeah.
No,
But.
yeah. But you know, it is sort of interesting that if the baseline is zero, you can get it to be 2% better by telling it that it's a GitHub contributor. You know,
What a fiction writer does bad, because I try to prompt the model to write fiction and it will give some even hacking for hacking code. Say you will write a fiction for a hacker, like
I
yeah,
actually
makes
think
sense.
like I don't know. I think it would be interesting to understand kind of like what happens internally in the model when you give it like the GitHub contributor. Like what does it activate that it didn't activate with like the normal you're just helpful AI? Like yeah, I don't know.
Yes, there are some like understanding personas in them. So there's a circuit paper that has.
Oh, I will be
That's cool.
cool if you can finally.
Yeah, go read that. And then we also looked at quantization effects. So presumably quantization should have a little bit of a stronger effect than changing the random seed. But it shouldn't, I mean, I didn't think that it should change that much, and that's what we found. So we compared quantization to just changing the random seed, and it had a small effect, but not a crazy one. Compared to changing the random seed with the ingredients. And then this is that slide that I talked about that says what's in the pre-training and the mid-training data mix for Olmo. The pre-training mix is 3.9 trillion tokens, 95% from web data. They have a bunch of data from Archive, Open Web Mac, Algebra, Wikipedia, this proof pile data set or something. And then they have code from Starcoder, which is derived from GitHub, removing any document from a repository with fewer than two GitHub stars. And then they, like, I guess, looked through a bunch to find weird documents and like remove them manually with some like TF-IDF stuff, I guess. They use a lot of like kind of like heuristics of like, okay, anything below and anything whose top two most frequent words constitute over 50% of the document, remove that. They had like a bunch of heuristics, and they were like, this kind of gets at, it's like 80-20 gets at most of the bad data. And then this mid-training data set was largely synthetic. So the purpose of this mixture is to imbue the model with math-centric skills and provide exposure to STEM references and high-quality text. I didn't include the actual what's in this, but it's in the paper. I want to go back and look at it, but yeah, I think we should spend a little bit of time like exploring this data and seeing what the heck is in it. So, and that's pretty much kind of the two things going on right now.
Overall question. So like I guess a lot of this data you've been looking at was more about understanding code or like rather than writing code. Do we feel like those happen at the same time or at different times or that they're intertwined at all? Like I feel like you could write code without understanding it, you know.
Could you? Do you think you could
You could
write
write
code
code that
without?
compiles without understanding it, sure.
I guess.
So I guess like, yeah, curious.
what the difference is there.
Yeah, I haven't. It's not really a question that I've thought about that much. I mean, I guess the main thing that I've looked at is, and again, this didn't make it onto the slides, but like a while ago, like a few months ago, I was looking at the human eval data set instead of the crux eval. And
Right.
so, human eval is like you have
That's
the
for
model come up, it's for writing code. Yeah. So, the model comes up with its own function for writing code, and then you're testing whether it passes this unit test. But yeah, I mean, I haven't really got, I kind of just switched out of that because why did I switch out of that? There was like a good reason for switching to crux eval.
I mean, evaluating written code seems harder than evaluating like an output of some code
Yeah.
snippet that you give it.
That's true.
But like if you want to have like general things about like capabilities emerging about code, like maybe that's a distinction to think about of like
Yeah.
writing versus understanding.
Yeah. That's a good point. I agree.
Are you still interested in the training data application?
Yeah, I moved away from it a little bit, but I am like interested. Eleuther is doing this thing. They're building like a whole repo right now on their interpretability channel
Yeah,
that
now that.
Nora Belrose is kind of making. And Stella asked me if like, I wanted to help build that. And so far I haven't really,
Like with this new result from Steven, so I sort of like, yeah, I'm not sure, but actually now that we see that, oh, it's actually like the setting that you're looking at, you have a pretty crisp view that, oh, it's just cleaning up the result. It's probably not a cliff. You probably have like a smoother probably when you get into the details, you'll find that it's more smoothly learned things. That like I'm actually more interested in the
In the
inference
attribution
function,
stuff
the
again,
inference function implementation maybe as a tool.
It could be interesting for us to like dive in and help build that.
It could be. Yeah, it could be great.
Yeah, when you explained like the grant proposal, I thought it sounded like an interesting setup to study like the whole old debate of generalization and memorization. Because like with code, you can kind of like maybe look at it more easily and more measurably. I feel like it would be easier to say whether it's really copy pasting because, and which parts copy pasting and at what point starts generalizing even more.
And I think there's like a decent amount of papers on that. So maybe I should go through them and then like think about how to just
Like it could be
literally
interesting
translate the
to
experiment from that paper into like
like
code
what
land.
they call
It could be.
maybe something to say about that.
But yeah, I mean that it yeah, I agree. I think I mean that was like one of my motivating questions originally for like being interested in interpretability was like I remember I had this debate with my boss when I was working in this in the biotech startup about like he was like, oh, LLMs are just stochastic parrots because he had like read that Emily Bender paper. And I was like, I don't think they are. And then I got like so engaged in that that I like started reading interpretability papers. So like, I am sort of interested in that.
Wait, what is it that convinced you they are not?
Using them a bunch, and I mean,
Interpretability at all.
I think my opinion now is that like say like the word stochastic parrot is like just doesn't make that much like I feel like it's just so ill-defined. Like, what are you talking about when you say that they're like just statistical like output? Like they are, but that doesn't mean that like that's not interesting, I guess, is like my current opinion.
They still might be.
Yeah, but well, I just think that the question, the like measuring what you're talking about when you say they're a
Right.
stochastic parrot is just too ill-defined of a
I
question.
see. I see.
Like, it's just not a very concrete, and I think that's why it got popular and like somehow remains popular is because it's not disprovable, because it's not, because you're not really saying anything. Like, what you're saying is like LLMs use statistics to generate outputs, which is like trivially true.
No, but I mean, in her paper, they go through this thought experiment of like, if you're never seen that world, would you have models of that world? Can you from just statistics? From just statistics, you can't, and that's their point.
I
But
see.
then if you don't think that they're stochastic variables because you think that they have these models of the world, they can connect things to the real world and understand them.
I don't know. but like just from an information compression standpoint, like there, you know, I mean, like at what point do you say that something is a world model? You know, like if you're compressing information, like there's a certain level of compression where I feel like you say it's a world model because like that's what we do in our heads. It's all about like compression, right? Like we have a compression algorithm in our heads that like takes all of the like very high dimensional input that we receive throughout our lives and turns it into like, you know, you connect to like some mental model, you know, and like to me, it feels kind of like there's no way that LLMs don't do some kind of compression because they have to, because that's like, you know, there's a limited amount of space in the weights and they clearly are successful at like repeating stuff, you know. So, yeah, like, I don't know.
When I think for coding problem, the interesting thing is that everything is in text. So, like, if you want to want model to interact with the world, maybe one simple way is just to look at, oh, if it does not compile, okay, what's the error message? And that's the feedback from the world, but it's still in the form of text. So yeah, I think it would be interesting if like take a look at how the if there's some error message, how the model like locates the error in the code, like how the error message and the code are related, the pattern of the like attention.
Yeah, I do think that that like binary probing experiment for like is it going to compile? Like that's kind of an interesting like thing. Like does the model know that in advance that a program is going to fail
Yeah, maybe not
if it
just the
runs?
whether the compile or not, but the exact error message with the code.
Yeah, but well, I the first thing would be, is there an error at all? I feel like that's like the easier version of it, and then you can get into what's the exact type of error, I guess.
Yeah, I think we should,
Yeah,
if we can, if we
that
can
is an
let the
interesting
model
question.
predict the error message. And here's the code pre-generated error message and with us.
Right. Is that correct? Yeah. Cool. That's all I got, guys.
So yeah, a little sense for what Alex is working on.
Yeah.
So if you've got any cool code LM ideas or attribution ideas, then Alex is the guy to share them with. Thank you, Alex.